Peter lives beside this Parthenon, former discussion session with Stefan Bartholdt. He can tell us something about some problems we have dealt with.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks. So essentially, in the second part, we talk about the model. So I just want to throw two diverse points into the discussion, where this is a speciation week, so to say. So the first point is I'd like to show some data about the statistics of species lifetimes, and how that makes me a little bit think about how good the picture of fitness landscapes is for evolutionary processes, in particular if you look at timescales, dynamic processes in evolution. The second is a toy model, toy scenario for evolution that tries to go beyond landscapes at some point. So in that it has a simple form of epigenetic processes of where you do not have a one-to-one mapping of genotype to phenotype. So. So the first point is a fossil data. So what I'm looking at, some of you may know of a fossil database compiled by Zakowski. And so here's just plotted for Brachiopoda and ammonites, two different curves of distribution of lifetimes to get these exponential curves somehow. And some of you may remember there was a controversy about whether this distribution of species shows a power law distribution, which might be interesting for from a statistical physics perspective. And part of what I'm doing here is I try to do a complete new reanalysis
what
of this.
Yes. The
frequency of species of genera you find per million years. So it's an interval. So here's this is just histogram. This is just a histogram with a few hundred data points each, and just this is just the number of species you find in every data point shown here at the interval of lifetimes between here and here. So if you want to know how many species are there of Brachiopoda which live between say 80 and 100 million years. So it's around here, so it's around one per million years. So this is just normalized.
So
on the
species or genera?
This is genera, and not families, genera.
Mm-hmm. How many genera of brachiopods live?
Oh, well, these brachiopods, actually, this is family data. So this is family and these are genera. So they're two different points.
Extinct, right?
The first time you saw them in the fossil record until the last time in the fossil record. And so there are some specificities in how, I don't want to go into details, how you can analyze these data from paleontology view, what exact interval you count. If you draw all the genera available from this database, you get something like this, which is a little better fitted by a power law of exponent minus 2.1 than by say exponential curves, so to say. So this is, well, okay, so this is some data. There was some controversy. This was actually a curve similar to this, a little worse, published a couple of years ago. Then there was a reanalysis of the 94 data, which gave an exponent of minus 1.7. And I did a reanalysis here, and from same data set, but I do not agree with the exponent 1.7. So this is about 30,000. So this is, there's still a few more coming, but. So this is the state I'm at now. Okay, so one could now ask what can be mechanisms. You just saw for the ammonites there were clearly exponential distribution. What gives you the sum of all these giving you such a steep power law, if it is a power law? So this would make it interesting what kind of mechanisms are underlying here. If you look at landscapes, just picked one of many well-known landscape pictures of models. Just this is the model of Russell Landy, who nearly would have been here this week from San Diego, who in 94 published this, some analysis of a diffusion model on a landscape where you sit on some fitness peak with a species and then you wander or diffuse around and according to some diffusion equation, and with some certain waiting time you pass this barrier of going here to the next fitness peak, so to say, for the species. And what he then, on the axis of phenotypic traits, observes is some fluctuating here, and it jumps up, fluctuates here, and this looks very much like the data of speciation that Golden Eldridge get in there. examples of so they had Euclidean measures of some animals where they pretty much get similar jumps, and this was a first attempt of modeling this. With respect to lifetime distributions, of course, long lifetimes here are exponentially suppressed, and if you try to get a steep power law distribution from fitness models, you have a hard time. So I'm accepting all kinds of ideas that you might have how one could get such data out. How it is for neutral landscapes, I'm not really sure of that, but of course one there has to face possible entropy barriers, so that would be another point that might be interesting to discuss in this context.
So you assume that species got extinct not because of their mass extinction, but only because of the daughter species that takes their life better, so the ocean.
So that's the picture of Landy in this paper. Of course, this is just a very crude analogy because nobody ever defined in this model what really this axis means. And what really this axis of fitness means, so what is a fitness for a species, is a rather...
Well, okay. It's a typical model of counter-adaptive evolution, right? So this model assumes that when speciation happens, its fitness temporarily goes down.
Yes, as you said in your talk, I mean, it's of course motivated by this. I assume Russell Landy was motivated by this,
yes,
of course. So here, I just was just looking at lifetime, the waiting times you need to go through such a barrier, if this would be a factor which determines speciation. So you could say, if there's an empty niche, how fast do you go into a new niche, or are you able to create some speciation?
You're assuming the concept of landscape diffusion and the concept.
Yes.
And what is neutral landscape?
When you, this is just an aside in brackets for those who would like to discuss. You could, of course, say here, well, if you, as you also showed in, of course, in your overview talk, if you here have to tunnel, this might be a problem. So let's take a flat landscape and just find some corners where we can sneak around and go there directly without changing fitness. But then, of course, you may have a high dimensional space where actually possible ways branch out, and the loophole you have to find to get to your other fitness peak by this way may be very hard to find. So that gives you again long waiting time. So that's what I mean by this. Okay, so this was motivation for a toy model where we abandon landscape. Yes.
What's the Euclidean measure of an
animal? Oh, I just no. Excuse me. I just what it was just a measure of what was this.
I
was just having an animal trilobite in mind where several measures were taken from his body size, so measures of distances of specific features all these trilobites show, and then some artificial scalar measure was defined by combined from a high dimensional space of features. And that was plotted on a one dimension, it's just as a scalar quantity like this, and you had specific jumps in these numbers which were summarizing somehow the phenotype of these trilobites. So and the papers by Gold and Eldridge, also in Gold's books, I guess, there are these trees where the species do not branch off but just make horizontal rather immediate abrupt changes. And to emphasize punctuality, and that's what Gold plots is such derived quantities of. So let's now consider a toy model for evolution in the presence of epigenetics of all properties of the genome, where in general genotype phenotype mapping is not linear anymore, and in the presence of a fluctuating environment, since both may be. Of course, problematic and if you consider evolution on a pure landscape. So take this. Yes. Yes.
What does it mean, abandoning landscape? If we have a space mm-hmm. of genotypes, mm-hmm. we can always attribute fitness to every genotype.
So no fitness.
No fitness.
I'll explain in the model.
If you don't have fitness, you will be dead.
No, then you have to, no fitness differences between.
So everything's completely new.
Flat. Yes.
So, okay.
Hmm? Okay, so let's just take this as a cartoon, please. So this is the lambda phage switchboard, which is of course very simple, but exemplifies just that there are some underlying mechanisms going on between genotype and phenotype that we cannot really assume as being linear and being really without any complications. Second aspect of what we have to take care about is fluctuating environment. What do I mean by this? So this is also, just take this as a cartoon. This is almost the whole genome of yeast in a microarray experiment, where every dot denotes the activity of a single gene of yeast. Actually, it's two experiments at two different temperatures, and the color shows you, the yellow shows you that nothing changed in the activity of the gene when the temperature was raised. The red ones show that these genes are becoming more active, and the green ones show that the genes are becoming less active when you raise the temperature. So this shows you that a lot is going on the genotype-phenotype map by just raising a simple environmental parameter, so that again the model of a simple fitness function mapping genotype to phenotype and fitness may be quite difficult. So what we've played with is a little model just taking into account both of these aspects. So this slide is basically the central message with the model on it. We consider actually not a fitness function or a fixed fitness function, but as a function, we consider the dynamics of a type of neural networks, just a discrete network, where every node is determined in its dynamics just by the sign of the input sum, some weighted sum with weight which is going to be plus or minus one, in a diluted weight matrix, with a specific property that this may be asymmetric. So it's motivated a little bit by gene regulation networks. We have genes that switch each other on and off. But it's just not meant as a serious model for gene regulation, but it's just the simplest model that we could think of, which has such a property that it does not only have one fitness value, because it depends on environment data. The environment data here is the initial conditions you put on the genes. So you just take the network in one initial state of some of them switched on and off, and then let the dynamics run. You get an expression pattern, a dynamic pattern, which due to the asymmetric couplings here may be also not only a fixed point, but also cyclic attractors. And this is what we call in this model the phenotype. So we just look at the expression pattern of a random diluted asymmetric network, and look at the expression pattern which then loosely may correspond to an expression pattern of a genetic regulatory network. So what is now, does this have to do with evolution? We now try to think of what could happen if one wants to evolve such a network in an evolutionary path. So just consider one individuum, mutate one of these weights in the network and see what happens. So we take the same initial condition, and if to take the picture close to biology, if you want to mutate a genetic network, you have to take care that the ontogeny is still functioning. So a very important criterion is that when you change the genetic network, you should still be able to produce an offspring to propagate your genetic material. So this is the only criterion which has to be obeyed strictly. So in this evolutionary scenario, accept a new net if the dynamics does not change for a given random initial environment.
I'm sorry, I've forgotten what K, capital K
is. Oh, I'm sorry, I actually did not introduce it. So this is the connectivity of the network, the average number of non-zero weights that come into a single node.
It's K.
It's K, yes. So and it's in these asymmetric networks here, one observes actually a dynamic phase transition or percolation transition, where above K2, damage spreads over the whole network because the signal then percolates through the network, and you get very long, exponentially scaling with the size of the network, very long attractors and transients.
This is
motivated by Stuart Kaufmann's things. This is a little bit simplified since we look at threshold networks. They have some nice properties. And this also has been looked at by Andreas Wagner in some evolution model, which you might know.
He is fixed for all I. I mean, he is totally independent, or he is
totally. We do not introduce a bias in K. Mm-hmm. That's what I mean by no drift in K. But K may evolve and will change as we saw.
But all I'm saying is that for mm-hmm. different genes, K is fixed. It's an integer number, say k equal to 2, means every single gene has precisely 2.
No. Everybody can. You can rewire it by mutating a single double weight, and then you change the k of a single node by just mutating it. So it's completely free.
Original k's would be
Poisson. Probably Poisson if you start random, and it pretty much remains the same over there.
And the initial W is randomly generated.
It's randomly generated. Also the yes, it's randomly generated. We have weights are plus or minus 1 or 0.
Yeah.
So
what's the biological difference?
Well, it's inhibition or excitation of.
So when you mutate, you only change one link at a time.
Only one link at a time. One element at a time is changed, and then you again apply the same initial condition then for the first one and see whether the expression pattern stays the same. The complete dynamics, the attractor and transient, it pretty much works for if you also take only the attractor, or you can also include the transient. It doesn't change the overall dynamics. Okay.
So.
Mm-hmm. It does. It since you only check for one, compare for one initial condition. This may very well happen. It of course, if you look at all initial conditions, it never stays the same. But that's also, as compared to the yeast data, we see only the activity of a few genes, and a lot of activity is hidden since we do not see all possible environments. Okay, so what is the dynamics of such a scenario? What one then observes is that the networks that emerge from this evolution process become robust, very robust against mutation. And here are a few observables that he has always shown, he's for instance shown the length of the limit cycles, the length of the attractors for a random network here with increasing connectivity of the network. For a random network, this diverges. For the evolved networks, it stays at a low level of activity. And actually, he has shown the networks that are accepted after mutation. And here on top is shown all the mutations that one tries afterwards. One could expect that if you mutate a network and that the period then jumps up here again, this would be if the networks were completely random. But this shows that the networks selected for by the evolutionary process have some inherent property in their wiring that keeps also the mutants at a very low activity, so to say. Yes?
Mm-hmm. Just that on the one hand, we've all descended from creatures that have evolved, and on the other hand, you know, when you have a scenario like this, of course it becomes robust against mutation because they die if they do the wrong thing. So, what kind of model could you have that incorporates both? That is, the stability against mutation, because that's a bad thing, but on the other hand, the necessity for at least some branches that evolve.
Essentially, this is a precondition for enabling your mutation, enabling evolution. So this says that the networks become robust, says that many more mutations of the genetic circuits can be accepted, in fact. And then afterwards, when protein networks in the cell or external factors change, then this gives you a very higher rate of branching than the random networks would have done without the ability to change. So this is ability to change. Essentially, you could also say these are more stable patterns. Here's a fraction of stable genes, of genes that do not take part in the pattern. It's much higher in the evolved networks. So you have some chance of not disturbing everything and to get the initial path away from a given network, so to say. Also, this is the activity of single nodes that are active is also somewhat down. So this is just to show these facts. just a brief view at what happens with the connectivity of the network, with the K of a long evolutionary time. You see here that one gets some intermittent dynamics with long stasis, long waiting times at high connectivity, and very short and high evolutionary activity with small connectivity. So one could think of that it is easier to mutate networks which are easier in connection pattern, and it's harder to mutate a network in a functional way that it functions afterwards if it's very, very complicated.
Mm-hmm.
This is one trajectory of always parent-child, grandchild, great-grandchild. So one chain. We allow mutations completely new in both directions, but this is, it stays here since the exit probabilities to find a viable mutant is much lower at a higher K. If you're up there, and it's much easier down here. The reason why it jumps down here is no particular reason in the sense that it just happens, and so it could have happened here, but it then decided to stay up here. But it's very much harder to go further up down, so this is rarer to go up.
So but once you have lowered the K, it becomes even easier to lower it further.
Yes, yes. So there are some activity. You could say there's an avalanche of subsequent events that lower it down there.
Well, K declines, it simply means that some W's become zeros, right?
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm.
And what is the number of genes?
It's kept fixed, and in these models it's 32 or 64. So we just look at some small networks.
So on when mm-hmm. you have this plateau, there, mm-hmm. the K through 7 is the average connectivity.
That's the average connectivity of
the spread that could be known to have connected to a lot more than 7.
It is pretty much Poissonian in this case. So it does not. We looked, of course, for whether there's distributions which have maybe single nodes which are extremely highly connected, but that seems to be not favored by this process, in a sense. Although, but it doesn't mean yes.
So, but those mm-hmm. nodes will resist coming down, no? This mutation.
Well, we know it did not look at single a change of K at single nodes, so it might be worth looking at it. Mm-hmm. So the distribution of these waiting times until you find a viable mutant, here we get a 1 over t square. So this is just the interesting statistics of the process, 1 over t square distribution. And if one runs a Fourier analysis over it, some 1 over f noise spectrum, this evolutionary activity. And this 1 over t square, one could ask now, this 1 over t square model, how can it be explained by this model? So here's some this is a speculation, the speculation slide. One could ask whether this has something to do with timescales that can in principle be set by evolutionary processes that operate on such systems also in nature. But this is the right side is the model. So what one sees here is that if you look at particular classes of networks of different connectivities, so say connectivity between 0 and 2, pretty much is this one here, or between 6 and 8, that is this one here, you get a very much longer lifetimes. But all of these are essentially exponentially distributed. And if you add these curves all together, then you get the 1 over t squared distribution. So the biased random walk process that we have here in K generates a series of coefficients that in this sum generates a 1 over t square process, so to say.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Not directly related to this slide. Mm-hmm. If you were to require that mm-hmm. the networks, if you accept this criterion, was not just identical dynamics for one random initial condition, mm-hmm. but for a particular random
yes, yes.
initial condition, but also sort of for radiation random,
for
radiation condition. You know, where you mm-hmm. have sort of a little region around your initial condition, and the dynamics should be the same for each initial condition of that region.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If that was the acceptance criterion, would you also get mutational robustness?
I, w- I would expect that you get mutation reversals then. I can't really say because we did not try this, but what we tried is that checking not only for one initial condition, but for a set of, say, 4 or 10 initial conditions. And that does not change the picture. So so we took a random set of initial conditions, which we tested simultaneously, and that's on the scale where you run the program, it increases the waiting times, but the overall distribution is not affected. So that's, from that, I would conclude that it is pretty much robust what set of initial conditions you test for. Yeah?
Your 1 over F noise in your graph,
mm-hmm.
One of the standard mechanisms for 1 over F noise is also to have wide distribution of some barriers, so out of which you have an exponential mm-hmm. waiting time. And so, for if you just concentrate on a variance of one type, you will get an exponential
mm-hmm.
Cutoff. Mm-hmm. But if you combine them together, you will mm-hmm. get all scales in the system, and you will get 1 over mm-hmm. F noise. Is it the same essentially if you just use the 1 over P squared?
I mean, the basic principle is the same that you here have different time scales of different objects, which are then summed together in a way that you get a power law. So the only thing here. And with this particular exponent, the only thing here is that you get a series of coefficients you need to put in front of your distributions here is generated by this random walk process. Mm-hmm. So then we could come back to the initial motivation shown in the fossil data in the beginning. Here's are some plots from the old paper of Van Waalen of 74, I guess, where he introduced the Red Queen effect. And motivated it by looking here at survivorship curves of, here's are shown Brachiopoda families, that's why I used the same in the beginning, and mammalia, and sees here exponential survivorship curves. So note that this axis here is linear, while this is log axis, whereas the fossil data from Zipkowski, if you show them all together, it gives you this power law. What additional information was in the beginning of the talk was that also if you do this for a species lifetime, so you here get the exponential curves, and if you sum these very same curves of lifetimes together, you get something which could be fitted by a power law, so to say. So this is I want to put it as a question in this group of, yeah? Mm-hmm.
Does it mean something that the exponent is supposed to be two?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe two emerges naturally when you have the
But it's very hard to get two. There are many arguments of adding barrier passing times together to get exponents. And the natural thing would be probably you get a 1.5. But if you couple to some extra processes, say population size or so, then you get 1/2. So there are actually processes where you get 1/2, but in this case, you would also would not only expect it at the complete database level, but I then would also expect it here. So this is an order in the class, so that you see it at the order or class level I don't see, so these barrier passing times, if they apply to species or to a set of closely related species, then these arguments should show up in these plots here. And they do only show up if you take all marine animals, and even large classes or orders of marine animals, which would share broad spaces of niches and different environments, they don't show it. They show it on the smaller level. So I think there's something to explain in these data, which goes beyond just explaining one passing barrier argument in some form. So and then this is also what I would like to conclude with, that from the data there may be some indication, if one thinks this is power law, of course, that landscape models may not explain observed species lifetime statistics, And the question here is what correlates the different lifetimes of different orders and classes across all species that all of them together give this rather unusual statistical distribution. The second question I'd like to end here with is that we looked at a model of evolving epigenetic structures and saw that robustness of these structures may emerge and modulated evolutionary speeds within this model. And so my question here was, also since there are many population geneticists present, what implications could this have for a full speciation scenario? Could this be, for instance, could this turn up later on as a time clock or a time determining factor in the speed of speciation? So thanks very much.
What is the limit sliding?
It is a finite system without a Hamiltonian and has a dynamics which does not end up in a fixed point. So it is deterministic. It has a finite state space. So it is, at some point you come back.
But they also can have a equilibrium.
You also can
have a equilibrium.
You also can have a fixed point where it just stays. It's also possible.
Mm-hmm. Does it appear this exponentially long limit cycle? Do they appear at the same point when the giant component, giant connected component appears? Or?
Yes, it's pretty much.
But then it should appear at k average equal to 1.
That's because it's asymmetric weights. They say that they count double. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Did you try to make crossover between these large networks?
No, crossover in the sense of mixing.
Make a hybrid.
Yes.
From one and half W from others, because this might you might be able to relate it to data and interspecies crosses. Which, I understand that this is just a caricature of reality, but still it will be interesting to see if you will observe more or less the same pattern of genetic incompatibility between species. This might be one way of relating this to real genetic networks.
Okay, you see. Okay, so
we've got data by Chen Yu, what happens when you mix genes from two species, what kind of incompatibilities you find, and this might be relevant to this kind of network.
Okay, so yeah, it's. Or do you think one could just mix two networks with a architecture, or is there some?
Probably can be done in different ways, but for example, you take 50% of your coefficients from one network and 50% from the other network. This hybrid network may be very bad, and then you will see what kind of pairwise interactions between different doubles in the possible.
This is single lineage, just there's no population inside.
So it would be very surprising if this would tell you anything about lifetimes of species. Because you know there are lots of species, and you don't know that the death of one is correlated with the birth of another one necessarily. And the things that are competing with each other may be very unrelated with each other. So if something evolved away over here on one branch of the tree, but it competes for resources with something here, well, then that may be the origin over here causes the next thing to happen over here, right?
So,
you can't do any of that with one lineage, right?
Yes, of course, and do not claim anything in this direction, of course. But on the other hand, if a niche becomes free, what do you assume as a speciation rate? Which species will take over the route? So the most thing I hear discuss about or think about is maybe species have different speciation rates, and maybe they are correlated by common genetic network origin, or their genetic networks may be closely related. And how would such speciation rates end up in models of population genetics or evolutionary ecology? So can you, as far as I understand, well, what you usually assume for speciation rates for species in population models. It's just some U, some constant, or I don't know. So it's just speculation about whether there are other factors affecting species lifetimes than only population dynamics or ecological dynamics in geographical areas, for instance. So here may be some additional factor coming in to species lifetimes. It's just speculation, so I don't... Is it answered?
Okay, but yeah. The question is, why are you linking the origin of something new to the death of the old one? When you only drop one lineage, there has to be...
Oh, okay, so actually this is just the yes, right. Now I understand. So essentially this chain of ancestors that is generated in the model is practically only sampling an ensemble. So it's more or less what we do in statistical physics or in some Monte Carlo algorithms to sample an ensemble. You may generate such a chain which may also represent distribution you find in actual coexisting populations of single entities. Yeah. So it's not claiming that you have a really ancestor relationship that gives you more information than beyond sampling, I would say.
Mm-hmm. So your model means, in simple words, as long as the environment is constant, the phenotype changes, but the phenotype remains the same.
Mm-hmm.
Then the environment changes.
Yes.
And if all changes, the phenotype only changes.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Also changed before, but in the way you
put. Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So that's
mm-hmm.
the underlying
thing. Yes. Exactly. So I mean it's realistic in the sense that the time scale on which proteins, for instance, protein networks or some simple constituents in the cell change is much faster. Than evolutionary timescales of organisms. Also, the environment, that's one factor. Another factor is environmental changes are not only by environment as a fixed environment, but also by co-evolving animals or co-evolving species may change on a much faster timescale than your own lifetime of a species. So it's probably a realistic assumption to assume that changes in genetic networks happen on a much slower timescale than happen in environmental factors. Also, if you look at ancient parts of our genetic network that we share with Drosophila, that say some homeobox genes that organize our body axis, so it's practically much of it is identical to what we see in Drosophila, except for maybe some gene doublings or multiple findings of those, but you see that this genetic circuitry evolves on a much, much slower timescale than binding constants, than proteins, and also neutral mutations in the genotype for proteins that may surface later on. So what I would call structural genes evolve faster than regulatory genes. So this is maybe the essence of it. This is only, of course, a picture for regulatory genes, where each gene affects at least one other gene.
In neural networks, there's a well-known trick of how to make those attractors very stable. In other words, you need to make the weights, Vij, to be of a functional type.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
By a product of two vectors with some freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Are you sure that when you select for stability, are you sure you kind of do not evolve naturally towards a functional?
It doesn't happen actually. It doesn't happen.
That VIJs are.
Yes. It does not happen at all. And you could of course. It'd be interesting. I mean, there are some. You could, of course, evoke it if you say we have one fixed vector of stable attractor fixed point that we would like to evolve vector, then you could define a fitness function and make it evolve to this vector. And then, in that case, I would expect that there are scenarios where you would see this. But in this case, it would not help you if there is an environmental change, and it probably would.
The environmental changes are not very, that do not happen often, and there are only a few of them, then there will be kind of a.
Well, I don't know. It's an,
can would have be many memories. Mm-hmm. Can have up to 0.1, something like 0.8 times n.
Yes.
Or n
yes. 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 It might be an interesting scenario to look at, actually. Mm-hmm.
Just a very quick response. The Hopfield network critically requires on the interactions being symmetric, which in the genetic networks mm-hmm. is different. So I think that's where the analogy is destroyed in a very crucial point.
Could you explain why Hopfield network requires symmetry?
It doesn't, but in order to have an energy function, which under this updating dynamics decreases continuously to exist,
so it's just because that's what the physicists can calculate, the other ones you can calculate. Okay, so? Mm-hmm.